Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Joining us now is Dr. Aaron Cherry, who is a program manager in the Emerging Capabilities Development Arm of Northrop Grumman Mission Systems Advanced Intelligence Systems. She specializes in human-computer interaction research that focuses on virtual and augmented reality as well as swarming. Aaron, thanks so very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
Absolute pleasure. And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our strategy coverage. And of course, Bell sponsors this podcast. Aaron, Northrop Grumman is one of the two key participants in the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency's Offset or Offensive Swarm Enabled Tactics Program, which is certainly a mouthful, but the Offset effort just staged its fourth demonstration, this time at Joint Base Lewis-McChord. And the other company involved in this, obviously, is Raytheon BBN Technologies. In each of these demonstrations, you guys are really putting together small aerial drones and really not much larger autonomous ground systems. And you know, individually, they look remarkably benign. But actually, when you if you sort of bring them together the way you guys are doing, it's positively terrifying, actually, to see how these systems sort of methodically gather intelligence, identify targets, and then actually to begin to attack them. And it really is a bit of a watershed moment, because I remember about 10 or 15 years ago when these ideas were percolating, senior leaders were saying, hey, that's really useful in a backyard, but not operationally useful against China. Talk to us about the Offset effort and what it tells us about what the state of the art is when it comes to autonomy, machine learning, artificial intelligence, visualization. I mean, really across the piece on all of these technologies that we sort of lump together by calling them swarming, but it's actually the nexus of all of these things coming together.
Yeah, sure. Happy to. So first of all, I'd like to say this is, you know, a really exciting time to be in the military research and development space, especially in terms of AI, autonomy, and robotics. And I think Offset's a really great example of that. It's a really exciting program. So Offset has the goals by the end of the program. It's about a four-year program. So by the end of the program, has the goal of reaching over 250 autonomous UXVs. We're focused on urban environments, and our swarm is also focused on being heterogeneous. So if you've seen some of the recent YouTube videos, it's a combination of both air and ground vehicles. And we also, of course, explore human swarm teaming for controlling the swarm, which is, I think, some of the virtual and augmented reality aspects that you were alluding to. By design, Offset is focused on being an exploration program that is going end to end and touching on all these pieces, from the higher level command and control, and how does a swarm operator, you know, control a swarm of 250 drones, all the way down to that individual robot and the autonomy and other packages that that robot needs. Not as much highlighted in some of the YouTube videos, but focuses on the simulation as well. And how do you simulate a swarm of 250 platforms and quickly go from simulation to the real world? So by design, we're doing lots of stuff on this program. And because of that, when we talk about the state of the art, that state of the art really varies. There's going to be some pieces of the system that are much, I would say, more mature. And there's going to be other areas that, you know, might just be emerging. Another part of the system that kind of changes is just the fact that we're using commercial technology, and as you're aware, this space of small UAVs is changing every day. So we've been fortunate enough to pull in, you know, different types of platforms into our systems. And another part of where we kind of look at the state of the art is even the architecture that our system is based on. We are actually leveraging open source software. So we're bleeding edge using Robot Operating System 2.0.
Wow. And just to give people a sense of perspective, right? How many people are controlling those 250 individual elements?
Yeah. So first of all, right now we're at around 100 vehicles. So we're not quite to our 250 mark. Right. And we have another year to go. But at our last test event, which took place late July to August, it was about a 2-week event. And that was the one that was at Joint Base Lewis-McChord. And it was one swarm operator controlling over 90 vehicles. And what that means, it was that one swarm operator who was defining that higher level plan. And we actually define that higher level plan through a sketch-based interface. So it works on your laptop, it works on your mobile phone, it also works on a tablet. And we also have augmented reality and virtual reality interfaces as well. So have quite the ecosystem of control for human operators or observers. Now, while there was one swarm operator, there was still, of course, a larger field team. We had an engineer playing swarm commander. So as the swarm operator, you know, was tasking these higher level plants to the swarm, the swarm commander would be looking at the intel that they found in the environment and coming up with the way that she wanted to go about finding information on that range. And of course, we had quite a number of field spotters as well.
Wow. So one of the advantages you have, right? So the good news is the technology is proliferated. It allows global rapid advancement of the state of the art. The bad news is the technology is proliferated, so adversaries have access to the same technologies we do.
Right.
Where does the United States and its allies stand compared with where China, Russia, and a vast number of other nations are? You know, as somebody who's covered this space for a long time, you know, once upon a time, it was sort of the United States that was making, really, really good drones. And then you would travel around the world. And now some very, very small countries are actually really good at the technology as well. Where does the United States stand in this marketplace?
Honestly, so I think we... In some sense, it's hard for me to comment on where the United States stands from the perspective that I myself work in the science and technology sector. So I am bleeding edge, but not necessarily focused on some of the aspects of security. So my goal is to make sure that these bleeding edge programs get to transition to those larger programs of record one day. So for example, as I mentioned, I'm using open source technology, pulling in COTS drones. We on this program, we actually have the benefit of being able to be agile and work fast, since maybe the security aspect is probably, later down the road in the program. But one thing that gives me hope here is that, we use robot operating system, but there's another effort called Robot Operating System Military, or ROS-M. And that parallel effort led by other teams is to make sure that we do have that security in place.
What are the applications of this technology that goes beyond sort of the backyard syndrome?
Oh, yeah.
Because, right, so you're doing it for an urban application,
sure.
But actually, if you can coordinate all of these systems, right, and presumably you guys will be equally adept to connect these, for example, with sea surface and subsurface, right? I mean, there's really, you're only limited by your imagination, especially if you can get, a handful of people to control them with a really simple interface. What are the sort of applications that you can see for this, for those who are thinking about this more as sort of a interesting local, not something at range,
sure,
which might not be the right way to look at it?
Sure. Yeah, happy to. So first of all, I would say that beyond military, there are also, of course, other applications, disaster response, search and rescue, to providing a communication network, and obviously certain farming and agricultural applications. So just want to put that up there. From a military standpoint, one of the most obvious benefits to swarming, at least in the case of Offset, is having hundreds of platforms that allow a team to explore environments much faster. And that is especially needed in these dense urban environments. This presents the opportunity to go from mapping and exploring an area in days to potentially hours. But I think perhaps what you're alluding to is there's this growing interest in demonstrating that having many platforms that are cheap and interconnected might be able to help the military complete kill chains much faster and being able to complete these simultaneous kill chains. I'm really excited to see where the industry goes here. And there are other efforts at DARPA, like CESU, which is Systems and Systems Enhanced Small Unit, that is starting to look at that in more operational scenarios than right. necessarily the offset program might look at. Right. And they are looking at doing that in entire battlefields.
So to that end, right? So if you look at the nexus of all of this, we're still, we're a lot better off than we were 10 years ago or even 2 years ago. But if you look at the commercial state of the art, not to butter Tesla or even General Motors toast, but the autonomy technology we're seeing in the commercial automotive sector, for example, is dramatic advances in the state of that art. So if you're going to look 5-10 years downstream, where are we going to be in terms of each of these individual technological enablers, given the staggering speed all of this is moving forward with, right? I mean, we're going to 5G technology. That is a quantum increase in capability. We're looking at entirely new algorithms and approaches, right? Each of these interfaces, as you said, right? I mean, you're a tablet based with stylus to do something that otherwise would require sort of hundreds of thousands, if not like millions of lines of somebody doing coding, which you're not even that worried about, right? So where are we going to be in a decade? Like, how do we need to think about where we're going to be to make sure that we're intellectually ready to take advantage of it when we need to?
Yeah, I think the industry is, it's very interesting right now, seeing all the opportunities in the space, even outside of DARPA, and certainly looking at the direction that the Army is going with some of their programs. I think one that comes to mind is the Air Launched Effects Program. So it's really interesting to see how some of these things are coming together. And you're right, we really do, all these pieces really truly are starting to emerge from the human-machine teaming aspect to applied artificial intelligence, and especially with the communication networks with 5G, as you were mentioning.
And obviously, right, I mean, you have computing advances in that also, right? So that the Absolutely. More on board, right, is changing. Have you given any consideration to how quantum changes this? I know, quantum is one of those things that's a little bit like mirage, right? I mean, sort of it always seems to be 5 years out, even though this time around it looks like it's a lot closer than 5 years, actually, because, we have achieved quantum supremacy, and there are a lot of people who are working on this. But, I mean, does quantum necessarily change? What are the most interesting and important things that you think are going to give us that step change? Is it quantum? Is it 5G? Is it, what is it that you think are going to be the biggest enablers as you look forward?
Yeah, well, first of all, I think one of the reasons this space is so hard is that there are so many enablers that are needed. Right. In terms of quantum, there are certainly people within my company that are looking at that. That has not been the priority of where we have focused. We have upgraded our swarm over the years for more computation, but our systems are really focused on being a distributed system. So the compute is running on each individual platform, and we went from small Odroids, which are like souped up Raspberry Pis, to having NVIDIA TX2s and Jetson Nanos on our platform. So if you know much about those boards, those are still very small. Computational power. But for the most part, has not been a limiter for us. So we're able to do path planning and collision avoidance and those sort of things.
Visualization is key. increasingly, right? I mean, that man-machine interface, you know, we were talking before we got started about sort of spacecraft, right? I mean, SpaceX has redefined what a spacecraft control panel looks like, right? So I mean, if you have the Apollo control panel with, you know, hundreds of switches and dials, you're now at flat panel displays and actually do a lot of stuff, even with an iPad on its onboard, Wi-Fi or a network. When you look at the DARPA videos, and I commend everybody to go on YouTube and watch it because it is fascinating. Some of the imagery that's coming off of these devices is a little bit halting, right? I mean, it's frustrating for humans to look at sort of one frame a second coming off of things. What's the future of that man-machine interface that's so key? You know, like, and what part of it is important to display in a swarm that has so many, right? I mean, you have to make some prioritization decisions on what the human gets and what it doesn't get. And you have to make the right decisions on that, right? I mean, this is why this is so fascinating. Where are we on that man-machine interface? And how do you decide what's worth bringing to the human's attention, especially when you're dealing with 250 or 1,000 or 5,000 units that are being controlled by a single individual?
You got it. When you have 250 platforms, being able to look at camera feeds from all of them would certainly not be, would be very overwhelming, would be very overwhelming to say the least.
Yeah. So I don't think you need a study to figure out that's really not good, right?
Yeah, exactly. So our visualizations tend to be more focused on, well, from a UAV perspective, having a map and seeing where the platforms are located, seeing what tactic that they are executing at that time, because once again, you have many platforms executing one tactic, and being able to see, you know, which ones are which groups of platforms are issuing or accomplishing which task, if you will. Obviously that's very important. And also just the health and status of the swarm. We're a research and development program, so that's especially important to us to be able to look at battery levels and, you know, if sensor feeds are giving, you know, throwing appropriate data, that sort of thing. I do think that the human computer interfaces for swarm control is still very much, there's a lot of fun work to do in that space.
About the man-machine interface. Mm-hmm. I mean, over the years, there are those who've raised the concern that our adversaries that may be somewhat less ethically constrained than we are would actually figure out a sort of human-machine interface, as in a plug or something like that. And certainly these sort of interfaces are going to become more common, whether we're looking at eyesight replacement technology or auditory replacement, right? I mean, we've been working along those lines. I mean, is there any evidence that there is actually a benefit to building human operators that do have a plug, for example, in their heads? I mean, I know that for some this is far-fetched, but it's an issue that's come up often enough that I feel like I should ask somebody like you who's a specialist in this, right? Is there any advantage to having a USB port in the back of my head to plug in?
I think that could still be debated, but my colleague, in my case,
probably an advantage somehow. But anyway,
well, I think it depends on where you're on what the use case is. When they talk about brain-based interaction, you know, there's the active stuff where you might be using your brain to control things, or more. In the case of passive, it might be making recommendations or being able to classify when you're experiencing high, low, or optimal workload. Now, this isn't my work in Northrop Grumman, but I actually do have a colleague who does study that. And at the field experiment at Joint Base Lewis-McChord, that's another thing that we did. We actually brought his brain-based sensor out, and we hooked up our swarm operator, and we were collecting data out there while he was tasking the swarm, which was pretty cool.
That's amazing. How did it work? Using his brain powers. What is that? It's like Monsters, Inc. You know, she grabbed me and shook me up and down with her mind powers. So how did that work?
Yeah, in this case, we weren't using it for controlling the swarm. And I mean, in this case, he wasn't like input into the swarm. You know, as you can see, that might be a direction that we'd like to go. But that's not what we are focused on in that case. we were just collecting data for one of our classifiers and seeing, you know, getting some initial data in the wild, if you will.
That's very funny. Yeah, but I mean, right, so then you're not dealing with plugs, right? I mean, there are whole right. kinds of, you know, other ways of
Right. I would definitely advocate for, personally, I would advocate for the non-invasive sensors. The sensor that we had, you just wore on your forehead, and you could easily put it into a helmet. So I'd absolutely advocate for non-invasive when possible. Yeah. And I do say it has advantages, particularly with a classifier like high, low, and optimal workload. It could help right. know when to offload certain tasks to an AI or when to turn it over to the human.
And you know, one of the other pieces of this is that while some of this is very on board, right? I mean, the question that some folks are asking is, all right, so you, right? I mean, if you can figure out means of delivery and a right package, you can drop this package off anywhere, right? You could drop it off forward in the South China Sea somewhere or on an island mm-hmm. or what have you to do that kind of reconnaissance and persistent surveillance in advance of, for example, you know, human troops arriving somewhere.
Sure.
The question, though, always comes up is, that this tends to work well if you're in a permissive communications environment.
Yeah.
What are the challenges of this working as its own self-contained ecosystem in a place that is sort of an MCON alpha, a highly jammed or communications denied environment?
Yeah, that it certainly changes and becomes a lot more complicated. In the case of our swarm, we are using a mesh network. So everyone's talking to everyone, lots of chatter. However, when they do lose comms, they actually continue about their mission plan. And when they gain comms back, they're, you know, dial into C2. So there is absolutely, you know, being able to continue a certain amount of their tasking while comms denied. GPS is also a problem when you talk about those environments. And there are other programs that are specifically looking at how you do swarming in those non-permissive environments. And you might be using more of a vision-based approach for position navigation and timing, for example. And actually the DARPA-SESU program, that's one of the things that they're looking at.
What is it that attracted you to this field as an engineer and a scientist? If I recall correctly, you joined Northrop Grumman about 6 years ago. What is it that drew you to this field? Because really, from an engineering perspective, it would seem to be among the most interesting for its interdisciplinary nature. What is it that attracted you to the field?
Yeah, so as I was saying, my PhD focused on human-computer interaction, and by definition is extremely multidisciplinary. And I was in my postdoc, you know, building things and running lab-based tests. And then at the end of the day, you kind of realize that stays maybe in academia. And I wanted to have more impact and have some fun. And, you know, being able to run these programs, being able to take work that, you know, appears to be lower technology readiness and put it into the field as soon as possible and see where it breaks and then go back and do it again. That's really fun for me.
What is the key? You know, you said your specialty area is the teaming element of it, the interface element of it. What is a successful, harmonious teaming relationship? And I ask that with, as somebody who, you know, has been really somebody who's always tried to use the latest technology, right? Whether it was a Windows CE machine, whether it was a BlackBerry, whether it was Apple devices or an app. I remember using a Mac Gen 1 when it came out and, you know, would tell people like, hey, you can write your paper. You don't need a typewriter. You can use this Macintosh thing. You know, right? And we're still struggling to, you know, get, you know, everybody complains about Siri, for example, as opposed to saying like, wow, it's pretty extraordinary what it is that network can do. What does a successful, you know, what is the future of that interface at the end of the day? I know we talked about plugs and stuff like that, but what are the keys to getting that interface right from your standpoint? Because it's not as much that you include as you don't, right?
So first of all, I think there are many use cases. You have the much more literal use case of human machine teaming on a program like Offset, to people thinking more human machine symbiosis with plugs on the back of our heads, right? Just picking. But I think that there are, so I think there are, you know, many different types of use cases. And I think to that extent, there's always going to be a newfangled, you know, technology or you know, toy that we want to get our hands on in terms of like an interface perspective. But I think at the end of the day, the most important thing is the transparency back to the human. So if humans are going to be users of artificial intelligence, machine learning, and autonomy technologies, it's important that they understand the decisions that those algorithms and technologies are making. So at the end of the day, it's less about how it looks or how you interact with it. And it's most important that you understand and it's transparent.
And one last question, which is that line between manned and unmanned, right? So on the one hand, right, there is this, you know, scientists have signed these letters about autonomous systems and autonomous weapons. And it almost doesn't seem to give enough credit to how autonomous our weapon systems are, right? How smart they already are.
Correct.
In terms of the decision making that they can already make, right? What's the future of that line between human direction and because, you know, a lot of our systems are making an enormous number of decisions to get to their target once they're fired. I mean, they're pretty smart about getting there and how to explode and when to explode and when not to explode, for example, right? So where's that line and how do we, you know, I'd love to get your sense as this debate unfolds on what these lines really are like and what the questions really are before everybody leaps to the sort of the Terminator, right? Which is also constrained by the ethics of the operator, right? I mean, if somebody is unethical about how they're going to use technology, they're going to do it whether or not there's an international convention or not, right? I mean, if you want to use landmines, you're just going to use landmines. Where is that line and how do we need to think about it?
Well, as you were saying, these autonomous systems to a certain degree have been fielded for a really, really long time. I think what's starting to change is maybe the level of the autonomy. So we're moving to systems that might be more automated, moving more towards automaticity. And I think that automaticity kind of exists at many levels. Once again, it might be at that higher strategic level of how I'm making decisions or how I'm going to create imbalance within a scenario. Or it might be down to that tactical level or that coalition level, like in the case of swarming. I think oftentimes when we're talking about some of the use cases that you might be talking about, we might even going down, you know, another layer and looking at, you know, automated target recognition or something like that, where we might be using deep learning algorithms that, you know, quite frankly, are very black boxed. And once again, I think the line really comes down to the humans understanding the decisions that these algorithms are recommending and subsequently, you know, feeling like they have enough confidence to make a decision.
Erin, thanks so very much for joining us. Absolutely fascinating conversation. Look forward to talking again on any of these topics because I do think you're at the forefront of a true revolution. Thanks so much for taking so much time with us today.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.